Good afternoon. It is 12:02 on Friday, the 10th of September. Heck of a day, isn't it? Well, we're going to talk about it and a whole bunch more. Sitting in for Jeb Bradley, of course, the one, the only, Brody Deshaies. Brody, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
And, Not a problem.
Was that a new intro that I heard?
Yeah, it was
I like that.
Music. I thought you might like that.
I do appreciate that. Usually we go in very quiet, but I like that. That really sets the tone. This is a serious The Eric Scott Show. We talk about serious topics here. So, and as always, love to have the conversation with you and love to interact and to let the people of Wolfboro, my constituents, know, you know, what's going on in the national, state, local realms, and you know, share with them what we can do in Concord on behalf, on their behalf.
Excellent. Let's start off with a question, and I don't mean it to be insulting. Okay, you were very young at September 11th, 2001. So, as someone who really doesn't remember living through it. And it's funny, as an aside, I always wondered about people who said, well, I knew where I was when Kennedy was shot, and I was wearing a pink shirt and blue jeans, and I had beef stew for dinner, and, you know, I was standing here, and this arm was in the air, and it was like all of this incredible detail that people remembered. And I never got it because he was shot before I was born, about 2 years, actually. But then after September 11th, I got it because I remember exactly where I was, what I was doing, and in some cases what I said, because I was on the air that morning, which was a hell of a day. So what does it mean to you? Because it's like I said, you didn't actually
You're right, and I'll be quite frank with people back home. I was 2 years old.
Right.
So having the same kind of reaction to the footage that is still shown, or to the memorials that you know, where we remember these the brave flight attendants and pilots who tried to fight back, or, you know, people who are on the planes, or, you know, commemorating and remembering and you know, having moments of silence and, you know, solemn moments for those who perished because of these, you know, these atrocities, these terrible attacks that happened. You know, there is a different, I'm a little bit more distanced from it than someone who even, say, is 5 to 6 years older than myself, right? Because kids in elementary school, they'll remember it, right. Or at least they'll remember reactions of adults. I'm not even old enough, and, you know, people listening right now probably could have kids that are so young that 9/11 happened. They were born a decade after 9/11,
right?
Or even some people might have been born a decade after Pearl Harbor, who might be listening to this too, where Pearl Harbor meant a lot more to their parents than, you know, than what it might mean to them. But I shouldn't say it means a lot more, because, you know, 9/11 or Pearl Harbor, they mean a lot to all Americans, right? Remembering those attacks and the atrocities, and, you know, remembering those people who suffered through those things, and, you know, never forgetting about that. But there's something more personal, obviously, when, like you mentioned, you remember where you were and what you were doing and who you were speaking to, mm-hmm. and the conversations you had. And but I think the biggest thing, though, is, you know, especially in schools and stuff, holidays like 9/11, you know, where we remember the people who perished on that, you know, during those terrorist attacks, or even, you know, Pearl Harbor, right? It's important that those kinds of that there are lessons that are taught in school, so then people remember, why is this day important, and why are we remembering these people, and why did we have a solemn moment of silence after we did the Pledge of Allegiance in school, right? And that's, in some ways, that should be part of our civics education, in my personal opinion, right? And I remember being in Crescent Lake and Carpenter School, and you know, there were discussions about what happened on that day and why we're having a moment of silence, and, you know, maybe adults might, you know, teachers sharing, you know, maybe they lost a loved one, maybe they know someone who lost a loved one, and how this is a very important moment of reflection for our country. And the same exact thing too with Pearl Harbor also, though, to give another example, that's an older example, because Pearl Harbor was kind of, you know, that really, that was wasn't that the largest attack on U.S. service territory. Yeah,
yes.
On U.S. territory by a foreign territory.
Yes.
And the most service members die, you know. So, and that really, you know, that was like the 9/11 of that generation.
Sure.
Right. And
absolutely.
So, but the other thing too is as time passed, you know, Pearl Harbor Day has become less and less remembered. And I think we should try to prevent. I think Americans have done a good job of preventing 9/11 from being forgotten, right?
Yeah, I think so. The one thing that I wish that was remembered more were the anniversaries, which just happened recently, of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we need to learn from that history before we start dropping bombs again. But that's just my opinion.
Well, I'd like to think that after those atrocities there, and you know, there's historical debate about whether or not dropping the bombs were necessary, but you know, I'm not going to get into that.
Right,
whole,
you could argue that one all day long.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into that hole and you know express my opinion either way on that, but I do think that after seeing what happened and recognizing the sheer power of nuclear bombs, and also understanding that if you drop a nuclear bomb in another country with nuclear bombs, that you know, you could have absolute Armageddon, you know. So I think that's another thing. You know, there are major atrocities that happen across the world, and throughout history that we reflect upon, that we remember, and we remember it, and we teach it in schools. So then the same mistakes aren't made again, right?
Right.
The Holocaust, Pearl Harbor Day, 9/11. You know, we remember these things, and we teach them in schools to grade school kids all the way up through high school. So then, you know, people remember, you know, these atrocities, and so they're not replicated, and so they can identify if they are going to be replicated, so they can stop it, right? Because we as a society obviously recognize we don't want those kinds of atrocities to happen. We don't want to see innocent people be killed.
Right. And I know we have taken some steps to step up air travel safety. One of the biggest ones, of course, is the hard cockpit doors that would stop a hijacker, theoretically, from getting onto the flight deck. But it's maybe it's me, but I mean, I've flown since 9/11. I don't feel any safer. You know, the TSA doesn't thrill me with confidence.
Well, I've never flown without TSA.
Right.
So for me, I mean, I can't say I feel any more, any less safer, but I would say people in the NSA and the TSA, a lot of the work that they do to protect Americans happens behind the scenes.
Right. I'm sure a lot of it they wouldn't want public anyway.
Yeah. It's just a lot of that work, and a lot of it's, you know, it's collection of it's collection of information, of counterintelligence and intelligence on what terrorists or, you know, suspected terrorists could be doing. It's getting warrants via the FISA court to be able to get that information. It's collecting data on what those people are doing who could pose threats to the United States, our sovereignty, and to citizens here. And so they do a lot to make sure that this country's safe and well protected. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, there's been arguments about, you know, I think here's a prime example. Us leaving Afghanistan, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think many Americans might have forgotten why we went in the first place and why we were there with, you know, and especially I think 9/11 is a, you know, 9/11 obviously priority should be to reflect on the atrocities that happened then, to remember those people and to pray for the loss of the family members. But it's also could be a time to reflect as to, you know, what was Afghanistan like prior to 9/11? And, you know, it's returning to that state again. And do we now risk letting the Taliban allow groups like ISIS-K or Al-Qaeda to train again and to commit another atrocity? Are we, even though we are remembering 9/11, we're remembering all those poor souls that were lost, are we also repeating history? Right? Are we repeating history again by letting Afghanistan fall into the hands of the Taliban and terrorist groups? Right. Does that pose a risk to the West? And could we end up seeing another, you know, atrocities like what happened on 9/11? And if the part of the point of remembering 9/11, one point is obviously to remember those that we lost and to pray for their family members. That's always first and foremost. But the second one is also to remember what we can do to make it so it never happens again and so we never forget. In my opinion, in some ways, letting the Taliban retake Afghanistan has shown that we forgot that second and, you know, less mentioned kind of reason why we remember 9/11.
Well, let's put it this way. When we're talking about Afghanistan, I look back at Vietnam, and I was always, you know, we were all told, even though I was very, very young at the time, I was in grade school, you know, but I've learned this subsequently. If Vietnam falls, it's the domino theory, and it'll take Laos and Cambodia and all of those other countries in Indochina with it. And that would be a danger to the United States. As you know, what happened in 1975, Vietnam fell to the communists, and the world didn't end. You know, I would go so far as to say that it looks like the domino theory was probably debunked after the Vietnam War.
Well, I don't. So was the domino theory over exaggerated? I would say yes. When Vietnam fell, did Laos and Cambodia and other countries fall? If I'm not mistaken, I think Laos was under communist control before Vietnam totally fell. And Cambodia did end up falling after too. And there were insurgent communist groups and counter insurgencies that were fought. And actually Malaysia, I believe it was Malaysia, Great Britain successfully fought against counterinsurgency by communists. And so it's more complex. So I think the comparison between Vietnam and Afghanistan are imperfect. And I know as human beings, you know, as people, we want order in the world, and we want to assume that history is cyclical, right? We want to assume that history does indeed repeat itself. And this is going to be ironic because I just said, you know, we want to make sure history doesn't repeat itself. But history really doesn't repeat itself because it takes different circumstances and different people and even different groups of people for specific phenomenons to happen, right? Now, sometimes there are some parallels between those phenomenons, and you can't deny it, right? For example, obviously, there was, I mean, part of what the Taliban is they want to establish an ethno state, and they very much prioritize, I mean, in many ways they're ethnic nationals for their specific ethnic group, the Taliban members, and people forget that, right? I mean, obviously they have a priority of you know, their fundamental version of Islam that they want to incorporate into the whole entire society of Afghanistan, but also that's equally hinged with their priority of making it so then that their ethnic group is the one that's controlling the government of Afghanistan. In Vietnam, you can also, you know, make that comparison. The Viet people, you know, they wanted to have their own state. And I mean, it started with even before Ho Chi Minh, right? Mm-hmm. There were intellectuals who even looked up to, you know, founding fathers and everything of the United States who were, you know, some, they ranged from being wanting to bring back a Confucius state similar to what they had prior to colonization, before French colonization, all the way up to people who wanted to start a democracy that was, you know, based upon what the current French democracy was, that they said, you know, actually the French system isn't bad, we just don't want the French people running this place. Right. So you know, in Afghanistan, they also had a broad range of people like that. So you can see obviously some similarities, but the similarities also are a fair amount different. And, you know, first off, in Vietnam, their ethnic groups were a lot more unified.
Right.
Right. And they were a lot more unified against one colonial power. And it was very clear that there was colonization with the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and even the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan. That wasn't really colonialism in the strict sense of the word. People could argue, you know, whether or not it was colonialism because of how, but in the strict sense of the word, it wasn't colonialism, right? Not only to mention that, though, but also the way that the counterinsurgency worked in Vietnam. I mean, you had North Vietnam that had its own state, right? That, you know, they developed their own communist state after, you know, winning their revolution against France and everything. And then supporting folks in the southern, the Viet Cong in southern Vietnam, and then a southern Vietnamese state that was established. I mean, very much more. The counterinsurgency in Vietnam was much more of a civil war. In Afghanistan, it's a little bit more blurred. You could view Afghanistan as a civil war too, but it's not as, you know, it's not as concrete the lines that are drawn, right, between North and South. There wasn't like an Afghanistan that was, you know, there was obviously pro-democracy controlled Afghanistan and Taliban controlled Afghanistan. But even in pro-democracy, you know, you had counterinsurgency and there were some things going on. And even in Taliban controlled, you had, you know, counterinsurgency and everything. The comparisons are fairly, in my opinion, imperfect, and also how the U.S. was involved. The U.S. was propping up what was, quite frankly, I mean, you know, the Diem regime. That was a totalitarian regime that was, you know, it was ran by an elite group of Vietnamese folks who were Catholics who had helped run the prior bureaucratic state with the French, and that weren't well liked, that oppressed Buddhists and other dissidents, and that didn't allow for, and we supported a despotic regime in Afghanistan. We didn't. That was a democratic elected regime that was had regular elections that were fair. The UN found the elections to be fair. We monitored the elections to ensure that they were fair, and women had rights. And Vietnam, I mean, you know, Vietnam was way different. And then the other thing too is when we left Vietnam, they actually sustained themselves for a number of years, right? I believe we left in 73, and Saigon didn't happen until 75. Correct. There was a 2-year period. Now, according to historical documents, Nixon knew, and his administration knew that they were going to collapse after 2 years, right? But we still ensured that we supplied them. You know, they were more prepared. We left Vietnam more prepared when we did our withdrawal. And we did our withdrawal, right, under international pressure that had been requesting us to withdraw for a very long time, right? So let's not forget that too, right? And the idea was that once we withdrew, that there was going to be a ceasefire, which did happen temporarily. Right. But the
wasn't worth the paper it was printed on.
Yeah, well, the Viet Cong didn't respect it. And Then the North Vietnamese, you know, decided that they weren't going to respect it either. But I mean, as you can tell, I mean, we left. There was no ceasefire with the Taliban when we left.
Right.
We did not leave the southern government. The pro-democracy government as prepared. When we saw that there was a collapse as we were withdrawing, we really did nothing to try to prevent that collapse. And we let all of our arms end up going into the hands of the Taliban, which is very disappointing too. And they got the parade around Kabul with all of our arms and all of our tanks and all of our supplies and everything. And now we gave more military equipment was captured by the Taliban than we've given to Israel in the last decade.
I'm not surprised by that at all.
No, and I'm pretty sure this exact conference, I'm pretty sure I said this last time I was on your show, and you said that you also were not surprised at all by that. But it does. I mean, it makes me appalled that they have that. You know, they have a very well. The Taliban has a very well equipped army.
Well, here's the problem I see with the Taliban is that the new government is mostly Pashtun, which is fine, but it is by far the dominant
The new government identity is people who are Pashtun, right? Who believe in a fundamental version of Islam and who seek to exclude 50% of the other part of the nation, which is women, right? And part of, I mean, they all, you know, everyone said, oh, this is going to be a different Taliban or this is, you know, it's different this time. But
it doesn't look any different.
Well, you know, and I won't say history repeats itself because it doesn't. However, I don't think it is repeating itself in any way. I think it's just a continuation, right? The Taliban that we kicked out of government Afghanistan, and as, you know, the prominent control over that territory that is Afghanistan, right, that nation state, their leaders never changed. Some of them died, but, you know, they had, you know, their kids have grown up and, you know, taken leadership positions, or some of them are still alive, right? And they said before they would take over that they were going to rule the country for the most part in the same way. And they're starting to rule it in the same way again. And they're going to discriminate against people who, for example, can't grow beards, or people who aren't Islamic, or Muslim, and people who aren't people who don't believe in their version of Islam, right? So other Muslims who say, well, I believe in a more moderate version of Islam, and I think it's more compatible with democracy, they will be oppressed too. Women will be oppressed. People will, I mean, you know, punishment in the streets, right? Physical punishment by the government will be done regularly. You know, this is, you know, and I know I said this last show, and I said this on my last show with my last show, All Things Politics, when we had Joe Kenny on, and I said this on your last show last Friday, but, you know, it really is horrific, and it's, you know, I hope it's something that after we're done remembering all those who perished on 9/11 and all those who perished trying to save those people, and, you know, I hope it's something that we remember where we say we went into Afghanistan to prevent 9/11 from ever happening again. And we know that if the Taliban takes over, they will let terrorist cells train people and export terror globally across the world. And that was the reason why we went in with NATO allies, because they specifically targeted NATO countries, Western democracies. And now that the Taliban has control again, and now that organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS-K have control and are working with the Taliban to try to form government or to try to reach ceasefire agreements so they can train their people and export them for international terror. I hope it's something that we do reflect upon too, where we say, you know, was this the best strategic point, and could this lead to another atrocity that we're remembering today? And I hope that we think about that seriously.
Well, there's also a $64,000 question that do we go back in? Or for that matter, why didn't we leave after we got bin Laden, which was the stated purpose in the first place?
The stated, you know, some people say that that was it. Oh, we got, I don't think that was a stated purpose in the first place. That was one of our purposes, was going there to get bin Laden and to, you know, get rid of the terrorist cells. But, more importantly, it was to establish a democracy that could sustain itself so the terrorist cells could never come about again, right? So cutting the head off the snake and getting rid of these organizations and then trying to create a democracy that could improve, you know, people's living standards and everything, infrastructure, economic development, so then people would not be, you know, not be turning towards these terrorist groups for whether it's acceptance in a social group, whether it's for, you know, these, I mean, people forget, groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they still do, they support their own, and they still do offer, like, for example, will help feed members and everything mm-hmm. and their families and things like that. And even, you know, obviously supplying martyr money, right? If you have a family member that becomes disabled, right, they'll offer a family, they'll say, hey, we will pay you, you know, massive sums of martyr money if they, you know, go commit a bombing. Right. So we went in there for more than just to get Osama bin Laden. I almost said Saddam Hussein. We went in there for more than just to get Osama bin Laden. Right. And we went there to also, we did go there to establish a democracy, to establish a country that could sustain itself and support its people and make it so that its people would not want to turn to international terrorism and would want to rather turn towards democratic institutions and government and creating a better and a, you know, the best government that they possibly could for the people of Afghanistan. And in that respect, we failed.
Okay, so what now?
That's a good question.
You know, what do we do with it now?
I know, you know, myself on my show and what we talked about Friday, we do, I mean, priority one still needs to be getting these Americans out.
Right. I got a couple of hundred out yesterday.
Yeah. So that still needs to be the priority, right? We need to prioritize that and any allies that are still there that we can help get out before they're essentially going to be killed and mutilated.
Well, I think we need to do that sooner than later, because the Taliban still wants to have that warm and fuzzy image. And what better way to do that than to let these planes leave?
Yeah.
You know, now, I don't believe that hype. I don't believe it's a kindler, gentler Taliban.
No. Anyone who says that or anyone who suggests that is
misguided?
I don't even think they're misguided. I think they're just fools.
Well,
quite
okay.
Frankly, I'll say it. I think they're being absolutely foolish to think that a group that's going to whip and beat women in public instead of having a trial and trying to figure out what actually happened. A group that's okay with people being sold into slavery, a group that's going to discriminate against people of Mongolian descent, because they can't grow beards. A group that's going to discriminate against other religious minorities because they don't like that they're a religious minority, even if they're people of the book. And a group that, quite frankly, would be more than happy to kill people who aren't people of the book.
You would think that they would be okay with other Judeo-Christian religions.
They are, but I mean, in their fundamental view, you know, they still have to, they have to pay an extra tax, and then they also can still be discriminated against, but it's just to the point where they don't have to commit jihad against them. So essentially, they're like, we'll tolerate you, but only to the point where we're not killing you, right? With other groups that aren't even, you know, people, and I say people of the book, that means the larger Judeo-Christian, the religious texts, because we obviously, we share religious texts with people who are Muslim and Christian, right? And people who are Jewish. People who are Jewish, just, you know, they have the Tanakh and the Old Testament, and people who are Christian have the Old Testament and the New Testament, and then people who are Muslim have the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran. But either way, these people are going to be there. I mean, it's going to be atrocious. They're already hanging people from our helicopters that we gave them, right? So, you know, Congressman Dan Crenshaw shared that on Twitter, videos that have came out of Kabul of them hanging, you know, people who, and part of it is because we left the biometric data, right? We collected data on anyone in the country so we can know who to let in and through checkpoints. And, you know, the Afghanistan government said, we don't want you to do this. You know, U.S. government, we convinced the Afghanistan government to do it with us. And we'd say, oh, we'll keep it properly protected and won't get out and won't risk people's lives. And the government fell. And now the Taliban has all that biometric data. And they get to see who we gave what clearances. And they get to know, you know, for the most part, where they were and where they were from and what checkpoints they traveled to, you know, from time to time, and they control those checkpoints, and they'll be able to say, oh, you match this biometric data. Where are you coming from? Oh, nice. So we know that you helped the U.S. with this stuff. Okay, so get in this truck, and your family will never be seeing you again.
Right?
And that's it's quite a terrible thing what is happening in Afghanistan. It really is. It's very disappointing. It's very sad. It's you know, obviously this current administration has completely dropped the ball, and we should have never pulled our troops out. We should have never created an arbitrary deadline or timeline. There should have been more to impose a ceasefire on the Taliban, and if they started their advance, there should have been more that we should have done to prevent them from moving on in advance as we tried to withdraw. And the withdrawal should have been done in coordination with our NATO allies. And obviously countries like France and Great Britain are very, very, very disappointed with how our leadership ended in Afghanistan. And even the British Parliament voted to denounce, you know, our unilateral withdrawal and leaving NATO allies there to fend for themselves and get their own people out.
The interesting part of this equation is the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are supposed enemies.
They are supposed enemies, but, I mean, only to a certain extent.
Well, I know this back, you know, in the day, there was quite a lot of fighting between the two groups. Of course, the U.S. had to play peacekeeper. But I thought it was fascinating that we as Americans really don't see a whole lot of difference between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Is it that we just don't know the differences, or are there differences much smaller than they think they are?
I think that's more what it is. This happens in political parties in the U.S. too, actually. And I'm not making a comparison that any political party is like, you know, these organizations. I'm just saying when you bring together like-minded people, right, the differences that need to be drawn between these groups become very, very small discrepancies, but they become very, very blown. You know, the proportions of how big those small discrepancies are become overblown. So an example would be like, let's say within the Republican Party, and I'm trying to think of a specific issue that we could use. Let's say I'm trying to think of a specific issue. I can't think of a specific issue off the top of my head. But, I mean, even within, like, a political party like the Republican Party, like, people will say, oh, that Republican is so much different than that Republican. But for the most part, we're still Republicans. We still have a lot of the same common tenets and ideas. We just may think of an implementation of a specific program that we want or, you know, amendment to a specific government program or, you know, an overarching view might be slightly different. And that slight difference will be played up in a primary, right, a Republican primary election. But for the most part, both Republicans are still very, very similar. They still agree on 80 to 90% of things. And that's kind of what it is with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, is that they probably agree on over 90% of things, but on the small things where there's discrepancies, they're going to overplay it. And why? Well, if you're the Taliban, you want to be the ones that run the country. And if you're Al-Qaeda, you want to be the ones that won the country or help run the country. And if you're ISIS-K, you're the same way too. The other thing too is Taliban is much more concentrated on jihad just specifically within their country and creating a state for, you know, kind of creating a government that will help, you know, usher in their perfect version of a Islamic, you know, caliphate. And ISIS and Al-Qaeda are much more worried about international, right? They believe that, like, it's kind of like the difference that I pose to people. It's like the difference between, it's the difference between Trotskyism and not Leninism, Trotskyism and Stalinism, right? With Stalinist communist, they believed, you know, and this is during, obviously, you know, after Lenin passed away and, you know, during the whole, you know, jockeying for power and how Stalin ended up, you know, purging people and everything, eventually ushering in his version of communism. But in Stalinism, the belief is that you need to ensure that every individual country has its own communist revolution and you go country by country and do it. Trotsky was different. Trotsky thought that the revolution was best when all workers internationally got together under one scope and decided we're going to have, you know, we're going to have revolution all together and we're going to topple everything all at once, right? So that's kind of how, that's the difference between Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Taliban believes it should happen country by country, establishing caliphates, and that they're starting with Afghanistan because that's where they can start, and then they can later help other countries establish these caliphates or other organizations. Al-Qaeda and ISIS want all Muslims to join together in jihad and usher in a, you know, a grand caliphate. And specifically for ISIS and Al-Qaeda, it's not international. It's, you know, specifically the pan-Arab world, right? So North Africa and the Middle East and then other areas where there's high concentrations of Arabs.
Right. Okay. So what do we do now? Do we just kind of look back on it and go, have fun, guys?
I think it's pretty impossible for someone like myself or yourself or anyone in the media to know what to do next without the intelligence that's necessary, right? Because the U.S. government has counterintelligence and, you know, intelligence from people on the ground. And each day that intelligence and, you know, your connections dwindle by more and more and more as it becomes tougher to keep connections with those people that you receive that intelligence from. But, it's going to be, I mean, at a certain point, you know, the ship is starting to kind of have sailed. I mean, we're obviously, there's not going to be this administration and any future administration. The American people probably don't want to go back in with, you know, as many troops as we went in with 2001 and retake Afghanistan and push the Taliban back and, you know, get rid of ISIS-K and Al-Qaeda and reestablish a democracy again. I don't think the American people are going to want to do that, right? We kind of got one shot, right? We were able to decrease our troop amounts and we were able to help, you know, the democracy stay there and everything. And we left and, you know, it didn't work. And I don't think we could convince the American people that going in again is the best choice at this point. And then the question becomes, well, then how do we fight against, you know, these terrorist organizations? It's just going to really come down to our TSA, our NSA, our intelligence agencies are going to have to really step up their game, and you know, we're going to have to provide them with the resources to ensure that our people in America are protected and that they're collecting and that other countries are also protected, you know, and that we share intelligence with them and they share intelligence with us, and that we really work double time to ensure that, you know, for the time being, groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS-K that are going to be rebuilding and probably very excited from their perspective to start committing acts of terror against the West, we're gonna have to be prepared. We're gonna have to prepare for a rise in terror attacks, in my personal opinion, and that's the next step. Because if we can't go back into Afghanistan, and if we can't push back the Taliban, these terrorist groups again, if we can't stop them from training and preparing people to go, you know, be martyrs and go kill people because of because they have a distorted view of Islam that's, you know, that's completely not in the the spirit of the actual religion, then we are just going to have to be prepared to really have a stronger defense, right? Because the point was our offense in Afghanistan was it's better to fight terror there than it is to be fighting it on our soil and in other Western countries. Now we're going to have to be prepared. We're going to have to find a way of how are we going to create a iron shield against these terrorists? How are we going to make sure that they don't commit acts of terror in our country?
I don't honestly think that's possible. Not maintain a free and orderly society.
Oh, you don't think it's possible for us to prevent them from committing acts of terror?
No, I don't think so.
And promote a free society?
It only takes one nut job, you know, with an explosive vest. And how do you stop that?
Well, you have to remember the way that people plan these things is typically done online. And there are ways for getting warrants to be able to see what they're discussing online and everything, to be preemptive and to say, you know, you're obviously colluding to plan acts of terror against the United States and everything. And we have a Patriot Act that, helps our intelligence communities do this. I think you're right. I think the bigger thing, though, is we're going to have to mitigate it. If we did nothing, that'd be terrible.
And I'm not advocating
doing nothing. Yeah, and I know, but I'm saying, you know, I know you're not advocating for that. I'm just being, you know, hyperbolic. Like, if we did nothing, that would be absolutely terrible. But we can do more and prevent terrorist attacks from happening, at least mitigating the number that could happen, in my personal opinion. I know you are right. It's going to be impossible to prevent all of them. It already is impossible to prevent all of them. Even when we were in Afghanistan, and even when we, you know, have the NSA and the TSA and, the FISA courts working to try to, you know, make sure that the proper resources are given to our intelligence community to find terrorists, there have still been terrorist attacks. There have still been people who were, you know, U.S. citizens who were inspired by ISIS, who decided, you know what, I was inspired and now I'm going to commit an act of terror. And that's going to happen, and there's nothing that we can prevent about that.
I want to take a minute and talk about the FISA court. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Yeah,
it's a secret court, basically, where they approve secret warrants. And I don't know how true this is, but the way I've read, about 99.5% of applications are granted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people think is that it was inspired from September 11th, but no, the FISA court's been around since the 70s.
1973.
Okay, thank you. I didn't know exactly what
it was. It's funny that you're asking me this because I've done a lot of research on the FISA court.
Cool. Then maybe you can kind of help me out. Isn't a secret court the antithesis of everything that's American?
Why did we start the FISA court is the first question to ask. Why in 1973 did we decide that we needed a FISA court?
That's a very interesting question, considering we just had gone through Watergate.
That's probably part of it, because the United States citizens wanted more transparency in government. And the reason why we did it was because there was a question over how the CIA and how the FBI got warrants, because before, they weren't really required to get warrants.
Right.
There was a lot of surveillance of U.S. citizens that was being done warrantless.
Right.
And so the Congress decided in a bipartisan fashion, they said, we should probably establish a system for making it so then people can get warrants, right? So one, people are protected, right? That that what needs to be provided by the CIA or the FBI or any intelligence agent, that they need to provide evidence that needs to be approved by a court. Right, a court, and the court is made up of 11 judges,
mm-hmm.
right? That those 11 judges approve of the warrant, and they also approve of the scope of the warrant, right? And so the reason why the approval rate, so first off, the reason why the FISA court was started was because of the fear that people have of the FISA court itself. The FISA court's actually working against that fear, right? It's making sure that government intelligence agents are being held to a specific standard that they need to set to be able to investigate U.S. citizens, right? and that the scope of their investigations into a U.S. citizen is, you know, specific, right? And that those are put into the warrant. And so then if a U.S. citizen is found of committing a crime or could be found of committing a crime and has to be apprehended, that that the U.S. citizen also has a right to say, wait, that, you know, the things that you looked into were not within the scope of that warrant, right? So then there's a paper trail too, and there's also a paper trail for how the warrant was collected. And those are specifically called, I believe they're called dossiers, right? Mm-hmm. What happens is the reason why the approval is so high is FBI agents will, between, you know, I know specifically about FBI agents, and I assume it's the same thing with CIA agents and et cetera, is that, and, you know, I keep using CIA agents, but CIA agents are mostly doing intelligence foreign, so they don't really have to deal with the FISA courts that often, unless the person, the foreign person, is speaking to an American citizen, then they have to, you know, go through the FISA court process and everything. The FBI, you know, they specifically do intelligence in America, and so they are the ones who deal with the FISA court the most. But they have these dossiers, right? And so if you're an FBI agent and someone says, you know, this person, you know, is saying some stuff, whether it's online or this or that, and they're hanging around with groups of people who we know have, you know, promoted terror or want to commit terror, or they've been in contact with a member of this terrorist organization internationally that, you know, has been looking to try to find people in the United States to commit acts of terror, you might want to see, you know, more what this person is doing and, you know, maybe go a little bit deeper. And so what they'll do is they'll try to collect as much information that they can legally, right? That's, you know, fairly public, and try to, you know, make connections and everything and try to show, you know, the court, you know, why they need the warrant and what the scope of the warrant will be. The courts, instead of just denying the warrants, will say, we need more information, and they'll just refer back to the FBI agent and say, you know, you need to make these changes. And then they'll go back. And what happens is sometimes, you know, the application process before it's denied or accepted will happen, like, it can happen up to like 10, 20 times, right? And so the reason why the acceptance rate is so high is because it's actually a testament to the FISA judges and the FISA court itself that, that they're ensuring that the FBI agents are held to such a high standard, and with these dossiers being passed back and forth between the FISA court and the FBI agents, that that for them to finally be accepted, the small number of them that are accepted, they need to really meet a pretty high standard. And you know, and the court typically is going to accept those standards that are met, because the courts say, these are the standards that we expect, and they'll show up and they'll say, you know, here, and they'll say, nope, more information, and they'll just keep telling them more information instead of denying it, right?
But this is a secret court.
It is a secret.
Authorizing secret warrants.
It is a secret court authorizing secret warrants, but the number of warrants that are actually, I can't remember what the number of warrants is, but it's like, I think over the last 2 decades, there typically hasn't been much more than about 200 total warrants,
okay,
issued in the entire United States from this that have been accepted by this court. And so typically FBI agents go to the FISA court when there's a very pressing issue, right? When there's a very, very pressing issue, and the FISA courts keep they keep the scope limited. And, you know, in some ways, the FISA courts create oversight over our intelligence community. And it is secret, but part of the reason why it's secret, too, is because, I mean, it is a risky job to be the person that's deciding, you know, and especially all of a sudden you could be a target of, you know, international terror and stuff. If you're the one who is, you know, working, or even more, being kidnapped, if you're the judges who see every single one of these warrants, right, every single one of these proposals, and has seen them develop over time and is the one approving them and knows all the information, you know, that's kind of a very scary position, right? And what judge would want to be put onto that court is the first thing. And the second thing is, you know, what terrorist organization wouldn't want to capture you for ransom money?
Interesting point.
Right? And so that's the thing. That, and the other thing too, is capture you or torture the judge. Right, they could capture and torture the judge and get all the information out of him, find out which FBI agents are the ones who are leading the cases on these, and they could go capture those FBI agents. So there's a reason why it is done anonymously, to protect for the most part, to protect the U.S.'s ability to respond to and to collect intelligence on terrorists, and also to protect the people who do that, right?
Now, I don't.
And ultimately, and even more, you know, to protect the U.S. citizens here, right? That's the main point of the FISA court and of these FBI agents. Let's not forget that. They are protecting our national sovereignty, and they are protecting U.S. citizens, right? And for them, I mean, the bar that needs to be attained for them to get a warrant is typically even higher than a regular warrant that you would need to get for someone who committed a crime here in Carroll County or in Wolfboro, New Hampshire, right? You need to be in contact, you know, someone needs to be in contact with international agents who have thought to be committing crimes, and then the crimes need to be, you know, pretty, you know, there needs to be pretty well spelled out, and there needs to be, like, there's a hole in these dossiers can be, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 pages long of evidence, and even still, the judge might say, well, you still need these specific things, or you still need to define your scope more before we give you the warrant, and then they kick it back, you know, instead of denying it to give them a second chance to make those amendments and everything, and then they'll make those amendments, and they'll go back, and then the FISA court will accept it, right? And like I said, I mean, there's probably, the FISA court probably issues less than, like, a very small number of warrants a year, right? Mm-hmm.
What concerns me are national security letters that the FBI issues, and they don't need to go to court for that. They can get your phone records, internet service records, things like that. And like I said, you don't even go through a secret court for that. They can just kind of do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know much about what was that again that you said?
National security letters.
Now, I don't know much about national security letters. I'll have to look more into that. I know a fair amount about the FISA court, because that was a big issue last election cycle, right? A lot of people were concerned about the FISA court. So when I had people asking me about the FISA court and me being like, well, as a state legislator, I don't do anything, you know, regulating or do much with the FISA court. But also knowing, you know, that the FISA court exists and understanding why people are concerned. I can certainly hear and I respect the concerns that folks have with the FISA court, especially with the way that's talked about, whether it's on whether it's in the media or whether it's you know, talking heads and stuff, people who share their political opinion for a living and everything. I personally think, though, if more people understood the FISA courts and the process, that there would be less fear, and they understood how many warrants are actually, you know, going out, that there would be a lot less fear. And I think that's something that's on our federal government, that they need to be a little bit more, you know, they need to be a little bit more transparent with how the process works. They might not need to tell people who are the FISA judges and where they are, or who are the specific FBI agents who are the ones who have, you know, create these dossiers and work with the FISA courts to, you know, attain these search warrants. However, I think people understanding how the process works, like how a dossier is created, and then how a dossier is given to the FISA judges, and then why the acceptance rate is so high, because the FISA judges will just request amendments rather than denying it because they see the pressing reason. And then, you know, what the echelon is for approval and how the FISA court sets the scope and ensures that there's a scope of the search warrant. And then also how the FBI agents can't go outside of the scope of that search warrant. And that if they do, that it makes it so then the entire, you know, if they open up a trial, there's a mistrial, right? You can't use that evidence. So, and then also how rare it is for them to, you know, once they collect this information, to actually apprehend Americans.
Yeah. I mean, they can't apprehend illegal aliens.
If there's illegal aliens in the country, then yeah, they're on U.S. soil. Yeah.
I'm not saying they shouldn't. I'm just saying they don't.
If I'm not mistaken, I do also think, too, that U.S. military members will apprehend terrorists in foreign soil and bring them to U.S. bases for tribunals.
Yeah, so, I've heard that.
So, and the other thing, too, is, you know, there are some times where a lot of this information that gets collected on the home side. I mean, sometimes it's just someone hasn't committed a crime, but they need to get a warrant to see if someone else has committed a crime.
Right.
And so they say, you know, the information that this person had implicates that you committed this crime, or that even more might be, you know, that they found that the information that they needed to prevent, you know, an act of terror or something. So it's complex. It's a lot more of a, you know, obviously no one likes the idea of secret courts issuing warrants and FBI agents, you know, collecting information via dossiers to get those, to get approval for warrants that they want. But I think if more people understood the exact process, you know, there'd be a lot less fear as to what this FISA court is and why. And also the first reason why it was established, which was to create oversight over our intelligence community, right? To prevent them from, you know, from collecting information that they shouldn't be collecting. So that's even the bigger thing, too, is that the FISA court in many ways is, even if you are skeptical and you say, I don't think the FISA court should exist, even with understanding it, you know, there's still the argument that, well, even if you don't like the FISA court and its very existence, and even if you understand exactly how it all works, it still creates some form of oversight over our intelligence community. So, you know, propose a better way of doing that, right? Because that needs to still be done.
Right. Don't they, I forgot what I was going to say. I guess it's not that important. In our remaining 7 or 8 minutes, I want to talk a little bit about masks in schools and mandates. Governor DeSantis of Florida got handed a rather stinging defeat on his anti-mask mandate. A Florida court blocked it and said that he didn't have the authority to tell school districts whether or not they wanted to do that. And I guess that's my question is, shouldn't the individual school districts make those decisions for themselves?
Depends on the state. I believe Florida is a home rule state. So there's specific powers that are delegated to the state and specific powers delegated to local authorities. Specifically in Florida, it'd be counties and the school districts in those counties. In their state constitution, my assumption is because they're a home rule state, there's very distinctive lines of control, like what the state controls and what the local governments control. And so that was probably why the Supreme Court ruled what it did. In New Hampshire, it's different. We're a Dillon rule state, right?
Please kind of give us the difference between the two.
Home rule means that local governments have very explicit powers that they control that the state government doesn't control ever, and then also vice versa, right? There are specific powers that the state will always control that local governments will never control. And in home rule, it creates a, you know, if there's no power given to the state government, it's assumed that it's then held by the local governments. It's, it creates a lot more of a distinction between what the responsibilities are for local governments and state governments in a home rule state, right? And a lot of powers are left to local governments. In New Hampshire, we have Dillon rule. Every power that our local governments have in the state of New Hampshire is given to that local government by the state.
Okay.
The state has all of, you know, has the authority to take or give powers to local governments.
Is that why gun permits are issued by local police departments here in New Hampshire?
I don't think that's why. No, I'm not sure why that's the case.
I just always wondered why the state doesn't issue a permit.
It might have just been just for more convenience.
Maybe.
Right. So, but I mean, the fact that the state decides where a gun permit is, you know, issued is part of the reason, because, you know, we're forcing towns to be the ones who are responsible for those gun permits. And that's part because we're a Dillon rule state. Right. Instead of a state, you know, maybe in a state like Florida, they could say, hold on, this isn't the job of our local government to be doing this. You know, it's the state's job to do this. So, you know, this violates our home rule. Right. We shouldn't be responsible to have to take care of this program. And, you know, in New Hampshire, it's different. Our state can decide what local governments can and can't do. We can't make those decisions. Right. It is the state's right. I don't think the state should do that, though, because I don't think one size fits all. I don't think that's a good idea, right? I agree with the governor that these decisions on masks should not be a top-down decision made by whether it's a governor via emergency or executive orders or the state legislature. It should be decided locally, right? People should go to their school board, give their input, explain why they're pro or anti-mask on students in schools. You know, maybe provide evidence if they want to, and I hope the evidence that they provide is fair and legitimate, right, and that it's founded in some scientific basis, and then for the school boards to make their decision based on the input from their constituents and based on the input of professionals and experts to ensure, because the other thing, too, is, you know, you don't want the school districts to be found liable for not taking common measures to, or, you know, or too many measures for maybe hurting kids, right? From either perspective, people who are very pro-mask, right? They might say, you have to take a basic measure to make sure my kid's safe. And if not, then that's negligence because, you know, the coronavirus is so novel and you know the effects it can have on people and even, you know, the Delta variant on kids. Or vice versa, people who are anti-mask that say, you know, masks can suffocate kids maybe or, you know, et cetera. And, you know, you have a job to make sure that my kid isn't hurt by masks. And if they're hurt by masks, then that could be negligence because you should have known. So it becomes, but it's for the school district based on the input of their constituents, of taxpayers in their community to make those decisions and to look at what the numbers are for COVID and Delta variant in their communities and to say, is this the best decision for our students? Is it not? Is it necessary? Et cetera, right? That should be a local decision, right? We let local governments, for the most part, make those decisions early on in the pandemic and, you know, up until a certain point, until the spike that happened last year about this time. Well, actually last year around November, the governor did end up coming out with a mask mandate. But even before that, we let local governments make the decisions. And New Hampshire had a fairly low, you know, spread as states go with our, you know, our per capita population and everything. And, I should say our population density, but I think local governments are the best at solving this and are the most responsive to their constituents.
No, I would agree. I there are many different parts of the state that are all very different from each other, and you're right. We don't need the state coming in and saying, "All right, here's how you're going to do this." Well, I understand they're coming from a good place, but that doesn't mean it's right for the local city or town.
Exactly. What's going on in Berlin and what's going on in Whitefield and what's going on at Kingswood High School or Memorial High School or Central High School in Manchester and what's going on in Derry, Dover, etc., Keene, it's all can be fairly different, right? Rates of transmission can be different. You know, the number of students can be different. Mitigation tools and tactics can be different. Some schools might have more space where they can say, you know, we don't need masks because our students can be apart, or we have better air filtration systems, or, you know, the rate of spread in our very rural community is just so limited that we're not concerned as much. And if you're in a, you know, in a school district like the Manchester School District, where, you know, you might have less room for students in a school, and, you know, you might not have as much air filtration within your schools, maybe you do need it. I'm not sure. I just know that people should give input to their school district. They should either politely email or call the SAU office, or politely give their vocal input at a meeting, and they should tell folks why they believe it, and if they're going to say that there's some kind of scientific backing to their opinion, that they give, you know, proper evidence that's accredited and that's been published in an accredited and a peer-reviewed journal.
All right. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but thank you once again for all your input and information. We do appreciate it. Brody Deshays, ladies and gentlemen, filling in for Jeb Bradley here on the Eric Scott Show. It is 1:00. News is next.